Here is John Crouch from American Angus Association, and his topic is the contributions. Basically, what he's going to talk about at least is the contributions of this committee to BIF over the years. We've changed his talk a little bit from what was listed in your agenda. Ultrasound will be part of his discussion because it was a big part of this committee for several years, but he's added some more to that in earlier years and in some more recent years, I think. Some of the things that have made really good contributions to the beef industry that's originated through this committee.
Hey, thank you, Robert. Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's I'm delighted to be here. I look back and normally the Baptists sit back in the back and everybody else sits in the front and y'all are spread around everywhere, so I don't know what to think about this. But at any rate, I'm tickled to death to be here. When Robert asked me to do this, we talked about giving a historical account of the development of the ultrasound process. And we have two young people right back here that have been a very, very integral part of it, J.R. Tate and Jenny Minnick. Jenny's got a new name now, and I can't remember what it is, but they were students at Iowa State University and worked many hours with the process. But at any rate, then Robert and I got to talking after that, and I said, Robert, this committee has had a lot to do with a lot of other things other than ultrasound. I think I want to give an account of that just to give you an update about some of the things this committee's been involved with over the years. And so, BIF was organized in Denver at the stock show in 1968 at a hotel there. And I tell you what, I was out there that year, but I wasn't too interested in the Beef Improvement Federation because I heard someone say that a bunch of crackpots had met over at a hotel, and they were over there talking about ways that they could weigh and measure cattle. And a guy turned around to me and he said, "Well, what's that got to do with the beef cattle business?" And at that point in time, I guess I didn't say anything, but I did remember that we do sell these cattle by the pound and by weight, and so it did matter. But at any rate, that's where it was organized. And the Beef Improvement Federation is just that. It's a federation. It's a group of organizations that banded together to try to come up with some sanity about the reporting and standardizing the reporting procedures for weights and measures, those things that had economic merit and value to commercial beef cattle production. I missed turning that slide down, and I'll just do it right here, and I think I've got a little thing that's going to help me here. This committee's been called several different names over the years. It started out to be Technical Committee Number 3, Beef Carcass Evaluation. That would have been in 1969, 1971. It was called the Beef Carcass Data Committee. In 1975, they changed the name to the Carcass Evaluation Committee. 1978, it became the Live Animal Evaluation Committee. In 1987, or thereabouts, I think I have those dates right, it became the Live Animal and Carcass Evaluation Committee. And in 1998, then the Live Animal Carcass and Endpoint Committee. In reading the account of the establishment of this technical committee number 3, I was able to find the assumptions that those founding members of this committee used in formulating what they wanted to do. The first one was the beef product is the end point of all beef cattle improvement programs. And I thought that's pretty profound. The second one was the quality of product and quantity of edible portion are basic measures of carcass merit. And I'd sure have a hard time finding fault with that. Then the third one was the relative value of quantity and quality are subject to consumer demands. And I think we still find that true even in our system today. Now, this technical committee, number three, recommended that they get into carcass evaluation. You know, we had already been into live animal evaluation relative to the growth traits, and it was relatively easy to get that data because all we had to do was to run cattle across the scale and weigh them and record that. And the first basic measures that we dealt with were weaning weights and weight per day of age. And things moved on from there. But this endpoint they knew was very important, but there was a problem. The real problem was that when we were able to measure cattle for endpoint, those cattle that had the good measurements never had the opportunity to become parents. And so it was a terribly, terribly invasive kind of a program that they were dealing with, but still realizing that some way, somehow, we had to come up with a way to evaluate beef carcasses for their merit in quality and edible yield or lean yield of edible portion of beef. Now, they wanted to follow the standards of the American Meat Science Institute, and I did a little bit of research trying to find what those were, and I couldn't even find that organization, so I have no idea what those, I had no idea what those traits were. But specifically, we did have grade and yield in place, so specifically, the committee recommended that USDA quality and yield grades be the standards used in any sort of a comparative program. In the early 70s, USDA adopted a new program called the Beef Carcass Data Service. And those of us who are a little older can certainly remember that. That program was a program designed by packers and feeders and commercial breeders, feedlot operators, and USDA and Extension. And it was a grand scheme because they designed a very unique tag, and that tag had a yellow shield in it, and they had those tags for sale. So BIF immediately got excited about that, and that gave rise to the formation of the BIF Beef Carcass Data Committee, which assumed the main purpose of getting the affiliated organization, members of the Federation, to buy groups of those tags and sell them. Now, you know, all good things start well, and a lot of them don't end well. Tell you what, even though the packers and USDA and the feeders and everybody else, you know, were certainly in favor of this program, what that meant was that caused extra trouble at the feed yard and extra trouble at the packing plant, and they didn't know what to do with it. There was a form, and they were forbidden by law to cut those tags out, and when a calf came through there wearing that tag, they had to gather the carcass data with reference to grade and yield, and they had to send USDA a copy of it, and they had to send the producer a copy of it. Well, you know, when these guys are told to do anything, they buck up. And I can give you an example about what happens in packing plants. Martin and Jorgensen and I got up real early one morning, and we were in a packing plant at West Point, Nebraska at 4 o'clock. We had found out that these people in the packing plant didn't much want to give us back that carcass data, but we found if we had one of those USDA official government tags with the orange shield on it, they were reluctant to cut it out. So we put those tags in the cattle's ear, just knowing that we were going to get that data back. So Martin and I were standing down here. The cattle were harvested, processed, and they started coming down the line. Now what happens then? The tag is supposed to be removed from the ear and put in a plastic bag and skewered to the inside of the carcass after the carcass is split down. Then when it comes down to us, when it gets to the USDA grader, that grader takes that tag out, shows it to us. I take my number 2 pencil on my big chief tablet, and I write that number down, He gives me all the pertinent information. I get the hot carcass weight off the carcass, record that, and we do that on every animal. We're standing there waiting patiently. Here came the first draft of cattle. And when they got to the grader, lo and behold, there were no tags in there, Henry. The tag was gone. You know what? They had hired a new guy that morning, and they didn't tell him about that. And we missed 102 head of cattle simply because they had put another man on the line that didn't know what that orange tag was, and we lost 2 years' worth of data. Well, Mr. Jorgensen was standing there, and he was looking around to see what he could find to hit me with, and I knew what was on his mind, and I left. Martin's not in here. He was in here just a minute ago, but I was hoping he'd be in here because he would certainly remember that story. But the problem was that the government didn't really like the program they put in place. We struggled with it for a while, and finally that program died from a lack of interest and a lack of participation. Emphasis was still made in this committee, was still focused on carcass evaluation. However, along about that time, people started looking at frame size, and they started looking at ways they could score cattle that had nothing to do with objective measurements other than maybe a measurement or a length measurement or a height measurement or whatever. And in a meeting that was held in the early 1970s, an ad hoc group got together, and they formed some other postulations and assumptions, and they said, among other things, that progress in beef cattle breeding could only result from logical, scientific, sound breeding programs. Well, that's a good statement. Then they said selection must be for heritable traits. No one would disagree with that. And then selection must be for traits of economic value. For example, trimness, muscling, frame, soundness, sex, and breed character. Well, that opened up a new can of worms, and they didn't know where to go with this request, so they came to the Carcass Evaluation Committee. Since the USDA carcass tags were waning, they thought they'd give this committee a new reason for living. And so an ad hoc committee on measurements and linear measurements was formed in the mid-70s. As those of us who were involved in the business then would remember, people were measuring cattle for everything. They were measuring length of cannon bone. They were measuring hoof circumference. They were measuring from the point of the pole back to the tail set. They were measuring the length from the eye to the nose, the width. I don't ever recall anybody measuring a tail, but Roy Wallace came out with a measurement that had a pull-out kind of a telescoping thing and a measurement tape measurement went down this way. And you could pull that tape measurement out and lay it across there. And it had a bubble on it, and you could get a height measurement. Everybody was measuring cattle. Test stations, David, started measuring cattle. And the first test station in my territory as a regional manager for the American Angus Association was in Salisbury, North Carolina. They measured those bulls, and what do you think the average shoulder height on the bulls measured in that test station was at 365 days? 73 and a half inches. It had been almost 74 and a half at the hip. So they weren't very big at that point in time, and probably we needed to do that, but it was in full swing. Well, this committee concluded that these linear measurements were being used very extensively. They had a standardized method for gathering and analyzing these data, for example, hip height and shoulder heights and whatever. So the committee went back to the board with their recommendations, and the board challenged the committee, and they said, well, you know, I don't think you've got any scientific basis whatsoever for asking BIF to do this, so go back to the drawing table and come back later. So they kind of got mad, and they changed the name to the Live Animal Evaluation Committee, with that frame race being on everybody's mind. Somebody thought that they needed to appoint a subcommittee to look at frame scoring these animals, to put them in categories relative to age, so everybody would know exactly what frame score they were. And so that frame score thing raged on and on and on and on and on, and they couldn't get anything done. Nobody could get anything done. So in the early 80s, a committee was appointed that consisted of two people. Now, the frame score guru in the country was a guy named Dr. John Massey from University of Missouri, who developed the original and first frame score chart. The second guy was Dr. Bob Shallis from K-State University. And those two gentlemen, scientific in nature, were charged by the committee to develop a frame score chart, and they did. It didn't take them long about it. The people were about to get mad, and they approved that in 1984, and it's been revised several times since. That frame score chart was revised in 1985 to go up to frame 9. Then it was revised in 1992 in a curvilinear fashion because they found out that the growth rate wasn't linear, and then that wasn't good enough. In 1995, they revised it to include animals up to 24 months. Now, a version of that frame score chart for bulls and females, British and continental cattle, are in the guidelines right now. So it took a while, but we finally did get that done. And I began to be involved with BIF, with the live animal and carcass evaluation, live animal committee, about that time. Now, other things that we began to look at were scrotal measurements and their adjustment, trying to relate scrotal measurements to female fertility. And so papers were presented on that in the beginnings of recommendations for the uniform gathering and measuring and adjusting of scrotal measurements came out of that. We took up udder scoring, as Lauren was talking about a minute ago. And I was implored as chairman of the committee then to come up with an udder scoring chart. And Jim Gibb, who is the director of research and breed improvement for the Polled Hereford Association, had already developed a chart, and I thought it was really good after conferring with several people. We felt that two things were awfully important in beef cattle udders. One would have been the size and shape of the udder, and the other would have been the size and the shape of the teats. Well, this simple system that Gibb had developed was perfect, and I took and reproduced that, and we developed some standards and some scoring procedures to go with that, and presented that to the board, and the board threw it out, and they said, no, it's not detailed enough. You don't have anything on attachment. You don't have anything about fore udders and rear udders and udder balance. And we said, well, we didn't reckon that made much difference in beef cattle because, you know, all they had to do is give a little milk and take care of that calf. Well, you know, we beat that thing around for three or four years, and finally here it comes back again. We've got another scoring system adopted in our system that very closely parallel that, but BIF will have one before very long. And that was in the early 80s when we started on that. Started talking about disposition. Had a guy come in named Harold Gagneau to talk about disposition and the possibility that disposition was related to some of the other traits that might be important. And he suggested perhaps that disposition might be related to the tenderness in beef. And I think that idea has surfaced again. I think there's some research papers that indicate that in fact that's true. Then we entered into probably one of the most controversial areas, eras of the entire life of the committee. I was in Denver at Stock Show in January, would have been in 1988. I got a call over the loudspeaker, and I went to the office, and it was Dr. Harlan Ritchie on the phone. He said, John, he said, you know, have you ever heard of this guy named Jim Stouffer from Cornell? And I said, I certainly have. He's got an ultrasound machine. He's been dragging over the country. He says it weighs about 1,000 pounds. He hauls it around in a 2-ton truck. And he said, you know, there's got to be something to that technology. And being a new committee chairman, I was anxious to get something on the agenda that nobody talked about before. So I called Jim and asked him if he'd come and give a demonstration. He agreed. I also got Dr. Patsy Houghton, who had done some preliminary research on feedlots with ultrasound in the feed yards at K-State. Dr. Lorna Pelton, who was a student at K-State at the time, and Dr. Bob Long to talk about skeletal arrangements in beef cattle and the bone structures and whatever. We had a good meeting, but when the meeting was over, Dr. Stouffer put on a demonstration, and there may have been 400 people at the convention that year, and 300 of them were out watching Dr. Stouffer put on that demonstration. So that was the beginning of the ultrasound process in the live animal and carcass committee of BIF. That process continued to grow and cry and develop and cry more and grow and struggle with tremendous growing pains because we didn't have enough equipment, or the right kind of equipment that could be hauled around to measure these cattle in a corral or in a squeeze chute. And an outfit called Corometrics kind of came to our rescue and developed a machine called the Aloca 210. Took a split image. Had to take two images to get a picture of a ribeye, and the only two things we measured then was ribeye area and fat thickness over the 12th rib. And we continued to struggle. We had a seminar at Cornell University and to further the technology. And shortly after that, we decided, okay, we're going to put something together, and we're going to get something working on this. So we started assembling people together, and Dr. Stouffer had a training session at Cornell. And a few technicians came out of that session that were trained, and JR, they started traveling across the country, then on an independent basis, taking measurements and interpreting those measurements in a hotel room at night and giving them back to the breeders. Shortly thereafter, that we decided that the process had to be refined, and we started toying with the idea of having a certification process for the technicians. First one was held at Texas A&M University, and Dr. Pelton was there, and it lasted until about 3 o'clock in the morning. I think we had 7 or 8 technicians, one of which was Don Schiefelbein, former breed secretary, now in business, in a ranching business in Wisconsin, or in Minnesota. And we only lost one steer. Only one steer got down in the chute and couldn't get up, and finally he was dead before when we got him out. And Russell Cross was not very happy about that situation. Well, we continued the certification process, and it grew into what it is today. But certainly not without bumps in the road, and certainly not without controversy. In fact, I don't think I've ever been associated with any technology that I spent more sleepless nights thinking about than I did the ultrasound process. But now, the way it's turned out, I won't speak for any other breed, but last year alone, we had in excess of 150,000 yearling animals go through that program, and we were able to generate genetic values on those animals for composition. And we've never had that sort of a situation that we enjoyed before. Moving on, we started later on then evaluating systems for that should not be body composition, should be body fat. Kept exploring ways that we could improve the process, and the idea of centralized image processing came up. In fact, it came up at a BIF meeting in a hotel in the Embassy Suites Hotel in Kansas City, and I vividly remember I was sitting in the meeting on a little round table. Scott Griner was there, and Doyle Wilson, and Gene Rouse. And I must give Doyle and Gene and Scott a tremendous amount of credit for the tenacity they had to stick with that concept and to ride through and to make that work. And we have four centralized labs now working, and I think the system's working extremely well. And we're able to get body composition, genetics for body composition on a tremendous number of yearling cattle, which cut about 4 years off the process. We, in the beginning, we didn't have a way to measure IMF, and through research from a lot of different people, that technology and software was developed. And now we can measure all four composition traits. We can measure external thickness, external fat thickness. We can estimate carcass weight through an empty weight taking scan time. We can measure ribeye area. We can measure quality through a measurement of intermuscular fat, which completed the entire process. Several other things in the early 2000s that we worked on. Box beef, the value of box beef. Dr. Northcutt from Oklahoma State gave her research on the value of box beef and related that back to sires. We knew we could do that, but I think nothing ever came from that except maybe some in-herd evaluations that were important to those people at that time. We recommended the use of guidelines for evaluating harvest endpoints, and I'd like to pay tribute to Dr. John Breathour, the recently deceased Dr. John Breathour, because he was a pioneer in that effort, had a wonderful system, was a gentleman and a scholar and a pleasure to work with, and Dr. Breathour contributed a tremendous amount to the ultrasound process that we enjoy today. We continued work, related research on the relationship between disposition and tenderness, and encouraged research on that, which has come to fruition. And I think we're going to, at some point in time, be able to generate genetic values relative to the relationships there. We even explored avenues for the use of DNA technology for determining carcass merit, examined ways to gather and further analyze data to determine feed efficiency, examined research relative to measuring tenderness in live cattle, tenderness on the rail, further refined the ultrasound certification process by establishing standards that each technician had to deal with and pass before we could be certified. Reviewed systems for evaluating both hardware and software used in the ultrasound process, and examined the relationship between phenotype and genotype in ultrasound and carcass traits. A lot of people have contributed a tremendous amount of work and effort, and I want at this time to recognize the committee chairman who have served this committee over the years. C.O. Schoonover was the first one, followed by Bert Neller. Bert Neller worked for NCA at the time. He was their representative on the board and was elected chairman of this committee. Louis Chestnut, who you heard Ike Eller refer to this morning, who was one of the original founders of BIF. Art Linton, who chaired the program and did a lot of really nice things relative to getting that mess on linear measurement straightened out. Bernard Jones, Jim Wolf, who's a rancher from Nebraska, Dr. C.K. Allen, who worked for Paul Herford, was also executive officer of the American Angus Association at one time. Dick Spader, also from Angus. Greg Martin with the Limousine Association. I was chair for 8 or 9 years or 10 years or whatever, and the last one, Robert Williams. And I would like to thank these gentlemen for the contribution they've had. They have a tremendous heritage. They've given the beef industry, I think, a tremendous amount of technology that has aided and enabled our industry to move forward in a production of quality beef. So, Robert, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share those thoughts with you, and it's excellent to be here for the 40th anniversary of BIF. Thanks, Robert.